Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou. Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. He's the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Welcome back, guys.
Hi, thanks for having us on the show.
Paul, I'd like to start with you. There was a very disturbing piece, in all the major media. I happened to see it in the Washington Post. On WashingtonPost.com, it includes a video, and it's three policemen who were fired after making racist, violent, racist statements about killing Black people. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think it's often one of those things when people hear, think about, you know, racist violence and domestic terrorism and that, they often aren't thinking that the police might be the perpetrators. And this is one of those cases where I think the only thing that's disturbing about it is that, or the only thing that's unusual about it is the officers were fired. But three police officers in Wilmington, North Carolina, were sitting in their patrol car, and it was being taped, of course, accidentally by patrol car's camera. And the police officers were Michael Piner, James Gilmore, and Jesse Moore, and they're using racial slurs. They're talking about murdering the Black residents of Wilmington, North Carolina, the very taxpayers that they're being paid ostensibly to protect and serve. And the language and the terms they're using are, you know, extremely vile and hateful and violent. One of the officers, Michael Piner, he's being quoted saying that with regards to protests, perhaps leading to civil war, he's telling another policeman, "I'm ready," saying he's planning to buy an assault rifle, and then, quote, "We're just going to go out and start slaughtering them, effing N-word," he said. And then it goes on about, you know, one of the other officers then saying, "Wipe them off the effing map, and that'll put them back about four or five generations," he says, referring to Black people. And it just goes on and on after that. And the unusual thing is that the policemen were fired. And of course, you know, what I would say is, you know, having seen this happen a lot, it'll be interesting to see if they get their jobs back in a few weeks or a couple of months after the media interest dies down, because that's also one of the things that routinely happens. These discussions came to light, and I think that's one of the things too, is it came to light by chance, because the sergeant was conducting routine video reviews when she found the clip from Piner's squad car that had been created by an accidental activation. And then she alerted one of her superiors to start an internal investigation. And it's interesting to note, though, that these are not new hires. These are veteran police officers. Piner had been a police officer since 1998. You know, it's 22 years. And the other officer, Gilmore, has been an officer since 1997. And I think it's just one of those things that just shows, I think, you know, both the inherent racism of many people that are employed in our nation's security forces, and also their contempt for the concept of freedom of speech and the fact that people have a right to protest under the Constitution. And I think, you know, a lot of things go on and on about when you hear officers talking among themselves and they're saying, quote, "She needed a bullet in the head right then and move on," Moore said. "Let's move the body out of the way and keep going." These were the words being used to describe a Black woman that had recently been arrested. I think when you see this language, these attitudes being expressed towards the people they're arresting, is it any surprise that policemen are killing people on a regular basis, especially Black people, when they have these racist attitudes and these brutal attitudes where, you know, they're talking about the people in their city, the people that they're sworn ostensibly to protect and serve, with such contempt and hatred, and also expressing those desires for violence? And I would say that none of this is good. I think one way to look at it is, if you're the person hiring employees, would you hire these people to work for you? Yet that's exactly what the city of Wilmington has done. The good news is, like I say, they have fired them, but we'll see if they stay fired, because as we've seen from previous studies that have been done around the country, 70-80% of fired police officers got their jobs back through arbitration brought about by union contracts, and they're virtually impossible to fire. So we'll see what happens with that.
You know, Kevin, we hear so much about, well, there are just a few bad apples. We have to look at the broader picture. Most cops are good. But it's not so simple as that, is it?
Well, I note that they tried to ascribe or suggest that the reason why these comments were made is because they were stressed out. They've been out there and they've been policing these protests, and it's really, really hard work. But, you know, if I get really upset and I've had a long day, I don't start to go off on racist diatribes about the world. So I don't know if that is a good enough excuse. I mean, it just means that they let their guard down and they showed how they really feel about all of us. And we know that that's actually been when we've had the most visceral reactions to the police is when they don't realize that they're being videoed, or they don't realize that they're being recorded. And that's when we've had the most ability to actually make systemic change, because now they're fully exposed for what they are as a collective institution.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I want to move on to the next issue, too. And that is something that to me is very disturbing. It's a little bit confusing, and it's frankly not getting the press play today that it should. And that is a superseding indictment against Julian Assange. The government came out today with a superseding indictment that does not add any new charges. There are 18 charges against Julian pending right now. This superseding indictment simply adds more information. It's window dressing. It says that Julian was going to hacker conventions in Europe to try to recruit hackers on behalf of WikiLeaks to hack into U.S. government systems and provide classified documents. It also talks about what appears to be a sting operation of some sort initiated by the FBI. Kevin, you've written about this for Shadowproof. Can you take us through it?
Yeah. So first, Julian wasn't going to these conferences because he was already in a legal trouble. And so he stayed put in the United Kingdom. And when he participated, he would do so giving video messages. But they do criminalize him. And I think what's most alarming about this and not being discussed is that this is a escalation in the nature of the prosecution against WikiLeaks. And you might say to yourself, you know, it was already quite the escalation, the fact that they were criminalizing somebody for the publication of information, going after a publisher. But they've taken this prosecution and they now go beyond the disclosures that we know about and have discussed over and over again from Chelsea Manning. And it now covers time in between 2009 and 2015, and they are seeking to suggest that Julian Assange was a participant in multiple conspiracies involving hacking. And that's been given a lot of attention by the establishment media sources in the United States that gave this coverage. What they are ignoring is the alarming way in which they're now targeting WikiLeaks because they provided assistance to NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden and helped him get out of Hong Kong to flee to some kind of safety. Of course, he was stopped in Moscow when the State Department revoked his passport and he was unable to leave the airport. He's there now, has asylum in Russia. And so they are now targeting the people. In the indictment, you can see they don't name them. They use their own way to conceal their identities, but we know who they are. They're staff members. They're talking about Sarah Harrison, Jacob Applebaum. They even mentioned Daniel Domscheitberg, who goes all the way back to the first year or two of WikiLeaks, and then both Assange and him had a falling out between each other. They're named because they spoke at these conferences, and it's a criminalization of speech, in my opinion, and they're going after these individuals because they celebrated the work that WikiLeaks was doing, and they encouraged more whistleblowers to come forward, and they see this as recruiting or soliciting leaks. And even though there's no specific criminal act in these messages, they are taking these very vague, inexact celebrations of the work that WikiLeaks was doing and the effect they were having on our knowledge of the world. And they're saying that this is part of a criminal conspiracy that Julian Assange engaged in against the United States.
Paul, what other reasons to issue a superseding indictment like this other than to influence the media or possibly the jury pool?
Well, I think the big thing is it's about intimidating and terrorizing potential whistleblowers and leakers into keeping silent and not becoming whistleblowers and not telling the truth about what government and financial institutions and other corporate wrongdoers are doing. And it's interesting is that doesn't really get that much attention, but, you know, this started under Obama and Joe Biden, this war and attacks on whistleblowers, and it's continued unabated under Trump. And one of the articles I read a while back said that starting with the Obama administration, that, you know, more whistleblowers had been prosecuted and imprisoned under starting with his administration than in the previous 200 plus years combined. So I think there's definitely more and more effort being put into terrorizing and intimidating people into basically keeping their mouths shut and facilitating this culture of silence and inaction.
Yeah, I want to ask Kevin a little bit more about some of these information troves. We touched on this just for a moment last week, but Anonymous seems to have stolen and leaked a gigantic trove of police documents. Kevin, Wired wrote a story about this, and you tweeted it the other day. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, and I actually respect the work that Andy Greenberg has done in this domain in the past. He's done some work on WikiLeaks and whistleblowers and hacktivism. And so he spoke with Emma Best, who's part of something called DDoS Secrets. And they actually, I mean, in a sidebar issue, this account was actually censored and removed from Twitter, banned as they were sharing these disclosures, which I think is, you know, another example of how these social media companies in Silicon Valley has been undermining our rights to freedom of expression. But basically, these DDoS secrets represented data that were obtained from a source from over 200 state, local, and federal agencies. And essentially, as Andy details them, it looked at what the police were doing to respond to the protests that were ongoing after George Floyd was murdered by Minneapolis police. It didn't necessarily reveal new information, but it exposed more detail about how they respond to protests and gave us information that we could use to try and discuss and debate and change the way that they act. The FBI was proven to be monitoring the social accounts of protesters and sending these alerts to local law enforcement. And they're specifically looking at anti-police messages. Now, that's fairly standard, but the fact that they make these dossiers is definitely, there are echoes of the legacy of J. Edgar Hoover in the way that they are constantly documenting these messages expressed by activists on social media platforms. There are other documents that were looking at Bitcoin donations. I think that's whenever you see them targeting these newer realms that are maybe harder to track, that's definitely alarming to me. There's internal memos that were also warning about white supremacist groups that were pretending to be Antifa and inciting violence. And then it's also pointed out that, you know, there was an odd way in which they would describe white nationalists like Richard Spencer, who's really well known, and they wouldn't label him a white supremacist necessarily, but they would call him anti-Antifa, which sort of undermines and misses the whole fact of like why he has his notoriety and why there have been counter protests and why he's been entangled in messes. So these documents provided a picture of how the government was responding to these protests, some of the ways that the private sector and the FBI were interacting to share. And none of the information is classified. But I think what Twitter probably objected to and what others have most objected to is that they shared some financial and some personal information about the officers because they just believed that knowing that this information was necessary because these are public servants who work for the police forces, they spent a lot of time scrubbing the information. I think they did a pretty good job of handling the data set, but there were some personal identifying details about the police officers that I think made it a sensitive issue. And there were authorities, I'm sure, demanded that Twitter make it harder to access these materials. But this kind of trove, you know, it comes at an incredible moment because you know, just no more than a few days later, we get this expanded indictment against Julian Assange that we just talked about. And it's amazing because in this story that Andy Greenberg wrote, he compares this to Jeremy Hammond, who was the activist who hacked into the Stratfor private intelligence firm, this intelligence consulting firm. That was something that WikiLeaks published files from. And now we have this indictment that describes this interaction that was ongoing. And in that case, there was an FBI informant that was involved in trying to entrap people into committing criminal conduct. And so now you have this happening, and it's one of the first leaks or one of the first releases tied to anonymous in many, many years. You could go back to like 2011 to find something similar that has had the kind of impact. You know, it's hard to tell. Is this group coming back? Are some of these people back, or is there something else going on? But far and away, we're better off to know more information about how the FBI and the police are responding to these protests.
Paul, going back to prison legal news, you know, we talk about COVID-19 all the time, and we talk certainly about prison systems in southern states all the time. I want to ask you about Louisiana's governor, who, for the record, happens to be a Democrat. He has refused to act to grant compassionate release to a grandmother, in addition to other prisoners, hospitalized with COVID-19. What's behind that decision? And what's the situation like right now in prisons in Louisiana because of this governor?
Well, I mean, the situation in Louisiana with COVID is pretty much the same as it is all over the country. It's terrible and dire, and infection is rampant, with little concern being showed for the life and safety and the well-being of the prisoners and the staff alike that are behind bars. And in this case, in July of 2019, the State Board of Pardons and Paroles recommended that Gloria Williams be granted a request for a sentence commutation. And this is in the context that Williams is the longest incarcerated prisoner in Louisiana, at least the longest incarcerated woman prisoner in Louisiana. And she's been in prison since 1971 for a robbery that was committed then. And when you think about 1971 is, you know, gosh, that's almost 50 years ago. And she was 25 years old in 1971 when they robbed a store and a shop owner was killed. And she had two other co-defendants. And one of them died in prison. One of her other co-defendants was granted commutation in 1987. That was over 30 years ago. And in the meantime, Williams has been in prison this whole time. And since she was recommended for commutation by the Pardons and Parole Board, she's 74 years old now, and she's contracted COVID. And right now she's in the hospital. She's been put on a respirator, and it's pretty touch and go. At least at the time we ran the article, it was still touch and go as whether she would be able to recover. And yet the governor still hasn't acted on the recommendation for her commutation. And I think this is one of those things that's common throughout the country, not just in Louisiana, but we've seen this around the country, both before and after COVID, with governors not releasing prisoners. And one of the analysis that we've done so far, Prison Legal News, is looking at prisoner releases of convicted prisoners from state prisons and federal prisons. And the numbers of prisoners that have actually been released is remarkably low, especially for prisoners that are serving long sentences. Like, virtually none of them have been released. And the attitude of prison officials and governors around the country seems to be, well, you know, they're locked up. We can or won't protect them. And if a bunch of them die, that's just too bad. And that callousness is being seen, I think, with spiking levels of COVID infections, coupled with what accompanies it is a rise in prisoners dying and being severely injured from COVID.
That's exactly what they're saying. I read, of course, Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News, and you have dozens of articles about this very topic. Prison officials just simply don't care. They are not going to release people on compassionate release, even if the law says that they should. What they do when you apply for a compassionate release is they tell you to take it to a judge and make the judge order them to release you. And so the numbers of people released have been infinitesimal. It's really been incredible to me. Kevin, back to you. We're starting to run a little short on time. We have some important issues I want to get to. We talked on the show several months ago about facial recognition software having trouble differentiating between Asian women. Well, now facial recognition software has led to the false arrest of a Black man. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, and this is being reported as the first documented example in the U.S. of someone being wrongfully arrested based on a false hit produced by facial recognition technology. That's what I'm reading from NPR. That's also how other mainstream sources have reported it, which seems pretty serious to me. I mean, the idea already, we know that there are deep racial... We started this conversation talking about officers who were fired because they were racist in their and they were caught being racist. So we know there are deeply held prejudices in the way people are policed. Policing tends to be racist. And so the fact that you're going to empower police to use facial recognition software to go out and arrest people, well, one, they're going to want to believe that the hits are correct because they want to do the least amount of work possible. But two, they also have no reason to question whether those hits are false or not because they aren't about to check their own prejudices. And so the Detroit Police Department were trying to find somebody who had stolen watches from a retail store, and they looked at a security photo. They had grainy footage, and they ran the person, and a hit came back. His name's Robert Williams, and they went to his home, and they arrested him. And when his wife said, "What is this about?" they said, "Google it." And when he was in the interrogation room, they looked at the two they took two photos that were from the surveillance camera, probably pretty grainy, and they showed him a photo of his state-issued driver's license. And obviously that driver's license was him, but those other two photos just looked like generic big Black guys, and they didn't resemble him at all. And, you know, I think this is a problem. He said, according to Williams, he told one of the officers, "I hope you don't think all Black people look alike." But I don't hesitate to believe that there are officers that don't distinguish features between these people. And I think if you look at the history of policing in the United States, and this is something that my colleague Brian Sonnenstein has been talking to me about a lot lately over at Shadowproof, and he's doing some work on it. We have such a history of viewing Black people as inferior and inherently violent criminals. And so it doesn't matter. You don't distinguish features. You don't try to see how their hair might be different, or you don't look at facial features like their nose, and you pick out their eyes. You just immediately believe that, you know, whatever you're going after, that big Black man is probably the criminal that needs to be arrested.
Paul, this can't be a new development, right? This has to have been going on for many years.
Well, I was going to say is that, you know, unfortunately, we report a lot on wrongful convictions in criminal legal news. And with the advent of DNA testing, we find that in case after case after case where there were, you know, eyewitness identifications even. I mean, I think this is the critical thing is we know that eyewitness identifications are inherently unreliable and very problematic. And a lot of studies and research have been done on showing that interracial identifications tend to be bad. They tend to be less reliable. And what we're seeing is that with the facial recognition software that's being pushed out by companies like Amazon and a lot of other companies, ironically, is mirroring some of the same problems. You know, it has some of the same issues that the eyewitness identifications have. We've seen time after time, though, that the eyewitness identifications are problematic. You know, people have biases. A lot has been done to try to address this, everything from how lineups are conducted to how eyewitness identifications are conducted, police suggesting who the guilty party might be. And I think that a lot of this has to do with, I think, how the reality of how police investigations in this country are conducted. And I'd say for the most part, they don't start out as an impartial, neutral search for the truth or to actually find who has committed a crime, but rather it comes down to, okay, who can we pin the crime on? And we see this time after time in wrongful convictions is usually years or decades after the fact when the person who was wrongfully convicted for a crime they didn't commit is finally getting out of prison And at some point, the lawyers or investigators for the wrongfully accused, they find the evidence where police systematically ignored every piece of evidence that didn't support their theory of the case or that didn't support the finding of guilt of the person they were charging. A lot of evidence will turn out to have been manufactured or suborned. And of course, none of the stuff is being turned over to the defendant's defense attorney so that they can use it to defend themselves with it in court. And it's one of very serious and ongoing systemic problems in our criminal justice system that we see time and time again. And the notion that interjecting technology into this process, which is still administered by humans, is somehow going to fix these problems, I think is turning out to be overly optimistic and flat out wrong.
We are going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala, who is a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. Paul's the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area, and in Kansas City on 104.7 and 102.9 FM and 1140 AM. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.